Hello. Thank you for tuning in. You are listening to ByteRadio.me's Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. For network or show information, visit www.ByteRadio.me or call 843-808-0777. And now, the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show with your host, Robert Sharp. Good day, everyone, and thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Today, my very special guest, joining us from Perth, Australia, is Carly Evans. And we're going to be talking about her global mission of suicide reduction and prevention. Across the globe, there are countless people who are feeling depressed and suicidal on a daily basis and struggling to beat it. In fact, many don't and choose to end their lives. As a result of this, so many more lives are impacted as their friends and family are left feeling confused, abandoned, and like they should or could have done more to help. We all want to feel happiness, peace, and contentment, and we all deserve that. There is so much pressure on us all this day and age where we're switched on 24/7 with huge demands placed on us each day. Most of us are stuck in constant fight or flight mode, and this takes a toll on us eventually. When we crash and burn, we feel like we have failed because we can't keep up with the rat race, and this can easily lead us into depression. When you add past trauma into the mix, it makes for an even harder emotional roller coaster. Carly wants to show people that there is another way. Life really doesn't have to be so hard. After a career spent as a corrections officer in London and as a community mental health worker in Perth, Australia, Carly saw countless people in the same boat with mental health issues they were struggling to beat, crisis and trauma such as child abuse that they felt they could not recover from, eventually all taking its toll and leading them to serious self-harm and suicidal feelings and behavior. You can find out more about Carly by visiting her website, which is www.coachcarly.com, and that's CoachCarly.com. And I do have a direct link to Carly's website in the show page description. So with that, I'd like to welcome Carly to the show. Good day, Carly.
Hello. Good morning. It's morning in Australia here.
Yes. Good morning. Thank you for getting up nice and bright and early to join us. I really appreciate that.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
It is my pleasure. So, the suicide it's just become such an ever-increasing important issue, in today's environment. And like I mentioned in the introduction, it's a global phenomena that has really, kind of got people struggling. And so, if you wouldn't mind, would you share with the listeners, what is it that led you? Now, you're a coach and counselor, so but what led you to kind of focus on the area of suicide reduction and prevention as a mission of yours?
Sure. Well, I suppose it was a series of unfortunate events. I'm not sure if anyone really chooses to get into the world of suicide prevention without having some kind of experience themselves. So my first experience of dealing with someone suiciding was a best friend of mine back in 2007. And I remember it so clearly. It was the day that I started as a trainee probation officer in London, and I got the phone call to say that a friend of mine, Christian, had died, and he'd committed suicide on holiday with his girlfriend. And it was a huge shock. He was someone who was the life and soul of the party, and ever since then I've heard of quite a few people who are the life and soul of the party who no one would ever know were feeling that way, who do commit suicide. And it's very unexpected. And what I noticed about going to his funeral was that it was so different from going to a non-suicide funeral, in that there was the range of emotions was so different, you know. There was lots of grief, obviously, as you would get in any funeral, but there was also a lot of anger and a lot of resentment, a lot of confusion and bitterness, and a lot of guilt as well, feeling that people could have done more for him. So as someone who had studied psychology, I kind of watched from a bit of an observer point of view, as well as a bereaved friend, and was just interested to kind of see that huge difference. Another friend of mine killed himself later that year, and the following year my brother tried three pretty serious suicide attempts, quite close together. And which was a huge blow to our family. And he, I'm extremely fortunate to say that he's still here. This was about, this was when he was 26, and he is now 33, happily married, wow, two gorgeous boys. And he never ever thought that he'd be in that position. And, you know, after the last attempt, I was cleaning up after him. And it was, you know, you go through so many different emotions as a sister, as a family member of someone who's made some serious suicide attempts. He had literally planned everything down to a T so that he wouldn't be found. So it's a miracle that he's still here.
Wow.
So, yeah, it was a pretty hectic few years in life. And and at the same time, I was in a relationship with someone with severe depression who tried to kill himself when we broke up. So, it, you know, it was a bit of a mixed bag in terms of why I got into suicide prevention, but I was also doing a career, I suppose, that where I worked with a lot of suicidal people. So I was also in that helping role, which I think also helped me through dealing with my own grief at the time, you know, having an understanding of it all.
Yeah, that's, you know, That's a lot. That's a lot of suicide, you know, around you. And being in the helping profession and having that happen, it just seems like, I mean, there would have been two responses: either for you to, you know, become more proficient in helping those, or just completely, you know, pull away and block that out. And it's good that, you know, you chose, you know, the first to be of a help for that. But I think, you know, when you mentioned you know, attending the funeral and the range of emotions and how it differed from other funerals, you know, I think, you know, the grief, anger, guilt, frustration, all of those, I think those are typical emotions that people experience when there is someone close to them that commits suicide. So, you know, in dealing with, I mean, I kind of like to look at each of them in a way. You know, obviously you have the grief, but anger. You know, where does the anger come from? What's kind of the seed of the reason people may feel angry?
That's a great question. I think that people tend to think that suicide is a very selfish act, and I've always been quite split about that. Yes, it can be, in a way, if you look at it in a certain way, it is probably one of the most selfish acts that you can do. However, people, when they're in that position, it's kind of flipped for them. So when you feel suicidal, you think that the world is better off without you. You think that you know, the people in your life are better off without you. So it's almost a non-selfish act from the person taking their own life. So, you know, no one who's looking on, if you haven't experienced suicidal thoughts yourself, the judgments that you make are completely different from if you've been there. And you know, if you have been there, you know that you're not thinking straight at all. And it's not possible for you to think about anyone else's feelings at that point.
Yeah, I can see that. And, you know, you're so right that many people look at that as being a very selfish kind of act. You know, I think people, I mean, you know, a lot of us have moments of depression, you know, so and we don't kind of take that next step, you know, we don't go that extra step to trying to, you know, kill ourselves or you know, go that extra, make that extra effort, you know, to kind of rid ourselves of what it is that is depressing us. So, with the guilt feelings that people may have, is it that maybe they weren't able to help the individual?
Yeah, I think that everybody in the suicidal person's life, if they do go on to commit suicide, I think that everybody has that element of guilt, whether you're a friend who feels like they could have called that person more, or maybe that person tried to call them and wanted a chat and that person didn't have time to speak to them at that point, and you know, or they're a family member and they feel like they could have done more to support their family member. I think there's always a feeling that you could have done more to help that person, and whether that's real or not, who knows? But you know, in this, it's so hard, isn't it? In this really busy world that we live in, we always feel like we could do more to see our friends and see our family and spend time with them. So I think it's a real, it's a real thing, isn't it? To feel like you could be always doing more, just in life in general. You could always be exercising more. You could always be eating better. You could always be spending more quality time with the people that you love. And so I guess we, as a kind of way of dealing with our grief, we take that on a bit and think, I should have called them more and I should have done this. But hindsight is a wonderful thing, isn't it? We don't always know what's going on for that person.
No, you know, that's true, and you know, quite often it is a surprise. You know, like you mentioned, your friend was like the life of the party. You know, and when we have a perception of someone like that, or the person is maybe very good at hiding, you know, what their feelings are, then it can be, you know, obviously a surprise, and then I think maybe we question ourselves as to, you know, how clueless am I? You know, why was I so clueless? You know, and then so I think that kind of, I know for a couple of friends of mine who, you know, have had, within this last year, had someone close to them commit suicide, and they were surprises. I mean, and those were some very common thoughts, you know, that ran through her mind, you know, as to how, you know, she prides herself on being a perceptive woman, and yet, you know, this kind of thing kind of flew under the radar.
Yeah, and we do kick ourselves, especially as a female, for a start, when we're supposed to be the maternal, nurturing types who should be able to pick up on all of that stuff. And if we don't, then we kick ourselves and think, I thought my judgment was good around this situation. And I thought that I would be able to pick that up in that person. And the reality is that people really only show us what they want us to see to a certain extent. And like you say, people can be really good at hiding things. And that kind of reminds me of, you know, like, if something in the animal kingdom is unwell, they'll do everything they can to make sure that that's not detected, because if they're seen to be weak, then they're vulnerable, aren't they, to predators. So it's kind of a bit like that, where we're constantly putting a brave face on things to make sure that we're not showing our weakness, we're not showing our vulnerability, because we don't see it as a good thing if we can do that.
Yeah, I agree. So, you know, I kind of mentioned a little bit about depression and suicide. So what do you think are some of the factors that contribute someone from kind of moving from just experiencing feelings of depression to feeling of a suicidal type of feelings?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that most people at some point in their lives do have suicidal thoughts, whether that's a fleeting thought or whether they're persistent thoughts is, it kind of depends on the person. But I think that, you know, the one of the biggest causes of suicidal thoughts and behavior is mental illness, isn't it? So, but whether we, and one in four people will suffer from depression. So, you know, that number seems to be creeping up in today's kind of society. But whether we have an adequate resilience toolkit, I suppose, is a big thing. Whether we feel like we have the coping skills to be able to deal with the trauma or the life changes that we're facing is part of that. And also whether we have a supportive tribe around us, you know, people that we feel like we can rely on, people that will, when we try and reach out and talk to them, people that will listen. And not just kind of lend an ear while they're on their phone or watching the TV, but really, really listen. You know, a lot of people who are suicidal are quite socially isolated. I've worked in mental health for quite a few years now, and most of the people that I've worked with have been suicidal or are persistently suicidal. So a lot of the kind of mental health work that I've done is in the severe and persistent end. So schizophrenia, major depression, bipolar, borderline personality disorder, that kind of thing. And a lot of those people are very socially isolated, and they don't, a lot of them haven't come from very stable families as well. So, you know, while many of us would have a nurturing family environment, and if we didn't, then maybe we found that within a friendship group. These people don't generally have that. So they've come from a background of trauma and child abuse and that kind of thing. And they've just spent their life kind of getting into that cycle of things that fuel that trauma for them. So drug and alcohol abuse is a big thing as well, you know, that just feeds into those feelings where it's an avoidance tactic, but it really doesn't help the suicidal thoughts in the end. You know, it leads to a lot of impulsive behavior, a lot of psychosis as well. So I think you've got that end of the spectrum where it's pretty major, major mental illness happening on that scale. And then we've got the kind of the other branch of society, I suppose, where they're not necessarily suffering from a mental illness that's that severe. They may be suffering depression and anxiety, which seems to be quite a common thread in today's world anyway, to have faced that at some point. But I think around that, you know, more women than men feel suicidal, but more men than women go through with it. So I think the big thing there is that women are much better able to cope with it, but also talk to their friends about it. They're more willing to reach out for help. So I think that's a big identifying factor between whether they have the support network. Yeah.
Yeah, that supportive tribe, like you mentioned, you know, and it seems that, you know, if someone who, you know, has a mental illness or, you know, just, you know, a challenge of some sort, you know, mm-hmm. you know, you talked about them being socially isolated. It seems that, you know, that the illness, I mean, I think a lot of people just, if they feel someone around them is, you know, mentally ill or has some difficulty, you know, socialization kinds of difficulties, that they distance themselves from it. So, I mean, it's kind of like it feeds into that isolation, you know, because, you know, how many people want to be around that? In a way.
Absolutely. And I really felt that for myself when I experienced depression as well. So after this chaotic few years that I described earlier, I went into a depression myself. And I see a big part of that as being not being able to exercise at the time. So I'd slipped a disc in my back. And so that was my number one go-to coping tool, was being able to exercise out the stress. And suddenly I didn't have that anymore. I'm a big talker with my friends, so I tend to talk through what's going on around me. But at that point, I felt like my brain was melting. And I could have written a thesis on depression at that point. You know, I'd done all the study. I'd done a degree and a master's in psychology. I'd, you know, worked with a lot of depressed people. I literally could have written A really, really good essay on it. but until I had it, I honestly didn't know. And I think the thing about depression is that so many people bandy that term around. You know, so many people will say, oh, I'm feeling depressed today. No one goes around and says, oh, I'm feeling schizophrenic today. You know, so many people say I'm feeling depressed when really they're not clinically depressed, and it invalidates clinical depression to a certain degree, I think. So, you know, people think that when someone is clinically depressed, if they haven't suffered depression themselves, they think that they should be able to snap out of it. So I think there's an extent of feeling quite invalidated in your feelings, that you should just be able to get over it. And I was someone who was the life and soul of the party, or I am the life and soul of the party. And I was always the helper. I was always the rescuer. And I had a big friendship group in London, but when I was in that position, I could have been surrounded by a huge group of people and I would have felt so lonely. And it's not that they didn't try to help me. It's that I felt like my friends got a bit scared, where, you know, I was always the one helping other people. And I've had this conversation a few times this week, actually, with other people who have also been in that role of helping other people. And then when it comes time to them needing the help, it's, you know, people kind of scarper a bit because they think, oh, well, I can't do a job as good as what they do. You know, I can't help her or him in the way that they've helped me. I don't know how to do that. I don't know what to say to them. You know, and so you kind of find yourself feeling quite on your own when you would expect previously that because you'd be the one to help everyone else, that someone would help you at that point. You know, so you do feel quite on your own. And whether that's really real or whether that's what your brain is telling you at the time, who knows? You know, when you're in that zone, you really do feel like your brain has melted. You know, I couldn't even read a sentence, and I couldn't actually finish a sentence at that point. And I could see the words, but I couldn't bring them into my brain, and I couldn't remember them. So it wasn't until then that I did recognize and accept the doctor's diagnosis that I had depression. And I fought that diagnosis for a while. But it's when I realized that my brain just wasn't working that I kind of acknowledged that.
Yeah, well, going through that, obviously, you know, that personal experience to that degree obviously had to shift the way that you helped people from that point forward, I would think.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, I've always said, you know, if I was someone who is addicted to drugs, for example, and I wanted to get off drugs, I would much rather someone was counseling me who'd also been there than someone who'd never touched a drug in their life. You know, because you can say that you understand depression, you can say that you understand what it's like to feel suicidal, but unless you've actually been there, that person that you're speaking to won't believe you. They'll know that you don't understand. You can't truly understand what it's like for someone unless you've been there.
Yeah. There's that personal experience. I mean, it is valuable, you know, people do have who are going through the challenge just have a natural attraction or affinity to someone who has felt the same, you know, who can identify all of the experience, and then who has shifted and changed things. Mm-hmm. And because then it's like, well, you know, they get it. they had it, they get it, and they did something about it. So, you know, all I need to do is get it and do something about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, like anyone in the personal development world would say, it's, you know, if you want to get something done in a certain area, just follow someone else who's done it and copy basically what they've done. You know, find a role model who's been there.
Yeah, exactly. So one of the things we kind of alluded to, but, you know, there seems to be a tendency for people to fear talking about suicide, you know, and you kind of mentioned that, you know, now if you know someone you know has attempted unsuccessfully to commit suicide, you know, there's a tendency to be like hyper vigilant about what you say. So can you talk a little bit about you know, what maybe is the basis of that fear of talking, and should we fear it?
I don't think there's a need to fear it. I know I definitely feared it when, as a sister. You know, when my brother had three attempts at that point, our family were not in a good space. We were focusing on my brother getting better. And then we got to a point where he was getting better. He got another job and he got into a relationship. And we kind of thought, well, what about us? We then stepped into resentment, I suppose, around, well, okay, you look like you're getting over it, but what about our family? You know, we've been through this with you. And there's actually a movie that's coming out called The Ripple Effect, where it talks about for every one person that suicides, there's 150 people affected. So there's all these other people affected. And when this person starts getting on with their life, everyone else kind of starts to, I guess, step out of the fight or flight response and start thinking about, well, how do I recover now? So as part of that, you're constantly treading on eggshells, you feel, you know, where you don't know what to say to that person because you don't want to say the wrong thing. You know, especially after three attempts, we were thinking, when's the next one? And if I say something to him and if I ask him any questions, will that make him want to do it again? So I think there's a real fear there of, if I say the wrong thing, then they'll go and kill themselves. And nobody wants that feeling of, you know, that having led to something like that. So I guess you just don't know what to say. And especially if you haven't been there yourself, you it's really hard to know what to say. But I actually wrote a blog on it last week and put out a couple of videos for World Suicide Prevention Day, because people need to be talking about this stuff. You know, it's an epidemic globally, and it goes across all demographics. This isn't something that is, you know, that's just with the Western world or just with a certain country or just with a specific gender or age. This spans across everybody. We all have a responsibility to be talking about this and to not just be saying, are you okay on Are You Okay Day, but to really be delving into this with people on a daily basis if you notice stuff like this around you. So we can actually ask really blunt questions. And when I did my training on suicide prevention, I was so relieved to be told that you can ask blunt questions. You can say, you know, are you having suicidal thoughts? Are you having thoughts that you want to hurt yourself or kill yourself or hurt someone else? And, you know, if they say, yeah, I am thinking about that, and they may not be honest with you, but if they are, that's a great starting point. And if they do, then you can ask them, well, do you have some kind of plan in place? People are worried about having a question like that or asking a question like that because they think that if they don't have a plan, then they'll start going to get a plan because you've asked them a question.
Right.
But it doesn't really work like that. As someone who is depressed and suicidal, you're not going to latch on to a question like that and think, oh, you're right, I don't have a plan, let me go and find one. You know, it's really about, if you know the person has a plan, you know, for a start, if they don't have a plan, then they haven't thought about it to the extent that, you know, someone who does have a plan, they know exactly when they're going to and how they're going to do it. You know, my brother, when I've had conversations with him about this, really frank, blunt conversations, he said he knew from as early as 13 years old that it wasn't a case of if, but when. And we had the same upbringing, you know, and that was a really good upbringing. you know, so that was news to me. But to ask someone really blunt, frank questions isn't going to make them want to do it any more than what they already do. But equally, the things that you say to someone who's depressed, it's really important to understand the, I guess, the impact that words can have on someone when they're feeling so bad about themselves. And I guess an example of this is when I was depressed and living with housemates, they sat me down for a house meeting and basically had a go at me for not taking the bins out and not pulling my weight around the house, you know. And at that time, you know, I woke up every morning wishing that I hadn't. So did I care about taking the bins out? Not really. But when they confronted me with that, I felt awful as a person, as a housemate. I thought, they don't want me here. I'm not wanted. I'm, you know, I'm not needed. I'm not a good friend. You really take all that stuff on. But if you're speaking and having an honest, open conversation, and you've managed to open the door with someone who's suicidal and you're having honest conversations with them, it's really about the delivery of the question. It's really about whether they feel like they can trust you, whether they feel like they can be honest with you, whether what they think you'll do with that information, you know, whether you'll just run off to the next hospital and call the police welfare officer, or really sit there and listen and be with them. And whether you have the guts to ask those kind of questions, I suppose, which is a hard place to be. I'm not saying by any means it's easy to ask those kind of questions, because it's really not. It takes a lot of practice.
Yeah. That's. I did want to refer the listeners to that blog post that you had, the three questions to ask. I thought it was great. You know, it was a great post, and for people who are in a position of just not knowing what to say, what to do, where to start. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a great way to get across some of the information. And like you say, it seems that the how you say it or what your intentions are when you ask a particular question seems to be really the most important. And if you come across as just being really interested in the person, you know, themselves, then, you know, whatever you ask might be picked up more positively than than anything else.
Absolutely. It's so important how you are with that person. And if you don't think that you can be that way, then I would say don't do it at all. Because it is so important how you come across. This person who is suicidal feels so unsafe. Like they're feeling unsafe. They're in an unsafe world. They don't think that they can keep themselves safe. So what they really need to feel is like you can help them stay safe. Nobody really wants to die. Nobody that I've ever spoken to who is suicidal actually wants to kill themselves. They just don't want to keep living the way that they're living, and they don't believe that their life can be any different. You know, my brother spent 13 years feeling that way, and I actually said to him in the end, "Wow, well, kudos to you then for leaving it for 13 years. That's amazing." You know, that's a really long time to suffer from major depression.
It is.
When you're depressed, a day feels like a week. A week feels like a year, you know? So 13 years, I can't imagine how that must have felt.
Awful. I'm sure it was terrible. Well, we're going to take a quick break, and I do want to invite listeners, if you would like to call in and ask Carly any questions, you can call in at 619-789-4359. And for those of you listening live in the chat room, if you have any questions that you would like for me to pose to Carly, feel free to type them in. And then when we come back, Carly, I want to talk about how one's own personal views of suicide, you know, or judgment, how that influences how you interact with someone who is suicidal. Okay?
Sure. Yep.
Okay. Everyone stay tuned. We'll be right back after this very brief break. Hello, this is Robert Sharp. I want to thank you for joining us and hope that you are enjoying today's show. Just a reminder that we have a wealth of information and resources available on our website, www.biteradio.me. There is a calendar of upcoming shows, along with an archive link to the approximately 1,000 shows that we have had over the past 5 years. Our show is available as a free podcast in the iTunes Store. You can subscribe there. Or even quicker, there is a link to our show on iTunes on our website homepage. We are also on many social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, Pinterest, etc. And we have buttons to those platforms on the top of our homepage. And finally, also on the site is a link to the great products we provide. Books, greeting cards, photography, and a wellness store with essential oils and personal and spa products. There is so much for you to explore and enjoy on our website, www.biteradio.me. I also very much appreciate you supporting our guests, and especially today's guest. And now, back to the show. Okay, everyone, thank you for staying with us. Again, today my very special guest joining us from Australia is Carly Evans, and we're talking about her mission, her passion of suicide reduction and prevention. And you can find out more about Carly and her work by visiting her website, which is www.coachcarly.com, and that's CoachCarly.com. And again, I do have a direct link to Carly's website in the show page description. So with that, we're back, Carly.
Hello.
Hello. Okay, I did notice on your website that people can sign up to get a free guide from you, 18 quick and easy ways to feel better. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I think, you know, for those of listening out there who really want to feel better would love at least even one way to feel quick and easy.
Sure. Well, as a coach, I look a lot at the scale of emotion, which is looking at the kind of range of emotions between what would be the real heavy, dense type of emotions like guilt, grief, shame, right down at the bottom. And then there's things like joy and love and abundance right at the top. So, you know, as a coach, when I'm trained as a law of attraction coach. And, you know, when I first learned about positive thinking and affirmations and that kind of thing, when I realized that when you're feeling really, really not good, it's too big a jump to go from feeling grief and shame to feeling joy. It's not realistic at all. So I kind of found myself wanting to put together a toolkit, I suppose, how you can creep up the scale. You know, there's a question that I always have in my mind and that I pose to my clients is, what's one thing that you can do right now to help yourself feel even a tiny bit better than you do right now? Because even a tiny bit is still creeping up that emotional scale towards feeling more neutral feelings. So I put together this list of really simple and easy things that you can do. Most of them are on your own and some of them are with other people. I think it's really important to build a toolkit of things that you can do there and then. If you notice that you're really not feeling good, you know, you look at the list, you can build your own list, you can add to it. And think, right, what can I do right now off this list? So it's things like, you know, just taking a few deep breaths or going for a walk or spending time with your kids or walking your dogs or, you know, meditation, that kind of thing. So just really, really simple tools. There's nothing complex about it. You know, when you're not feeling good, you don't want any complex tools anyway. I put together that list for people to download from my website.
Well, that's great. We know I just think it's wonderful that you take that approach of an incremental kind of shift because, you know, the one thing that I just find difficult for some people is the positive affirmation of, you know, I'm feeling wonderful today when you know darn well you're not, you know, and it's kind of, you know, I'm really not a fake it till you make it kind of person because I believe your subconscious knows better. It's like, you're not fooling anybody. You're not fooling
That's
me.
It.
The idea of what little thing can I do to feel even a little bit better? I mean, to me, that's ideal. You know, that's perfect. That's truthful. You know, it's honest and it's achievable.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And like you say, it's truthful and it's about validating how you're feeling. So we don't want to ignore the feeling space that we're in. It's just about allowing ourselves to feel a bit better right now. And, you know, with all these law of attraction tools, I really came to a point where I thought, well, this is all great stuff and I completely believe in it. And it's great when you're feeling neutral or positive. But what happens when you really just feel like death warmed up? What then? I felt like all of this other stuff was just a band-aid. So I really started exploring the other side to it. You know, when you feel really bad, when you're stuck in sabotage, when you feel like you're stuck in the mud and you can't move forward, I looked at developing some tools around that then.
That's great. So definitely everyone check that out and download that. Okay, so before the break, I kind of wanted to pose the question of how one's own personal views of suicide can influence how we interact with someone who is suicidal. And I guess the idea, what I'm kind of really trying to get at is that, you know, a lot of times there's judgment that comes into play when, mm-hmm. you know, when we're either when we're suicidal or when we're trying to help someone who is feeling suicidal. So how do, you know, one's own personal views kind of kick in, and is it in, when you're dealing with someone who is feeling suicidal, is it important to kind of put your feelings on the back burner and just kind of focus on the individual?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's so important to not allow your own judgments to get in the way. If you truly want to help someone, then, you know, if you can't allow your judgments to be left to the side, then probably the best thing you can do for that person is leave them alone and refer them to someone else.
Mm-hmm.
Make sure that you're not physically leaving someone on their own who's suicidal, but don't be the one to try and make it better if you don't think you can do that, because it's a bit of a dodgy playing ground at that point. So something that is springing to mind for me right now is when I was a trainee probation officer, in my early days of training, and I was writing a pre-sentence report for someone who was on probation for trying to kill themselves. And suicide is actually, it was still in the drop-down list when you looked at the list of offences.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how you could actually put someone to prison for killing themselves, I don't know. But he was on probation. He'd never committed an offence in his life. He was in his mid-50s. He was depressed and suicidal and also drinking a lot. And so he would be quite impulsive when he was drinking. And he had got in the car and then crashed the car. He'd actually driven into the wall of someone's home. So luckily nobody was home, but he'd crashed into the lounge room. So there could have been kids there. And he got caught and he got put on probation. So imagine how awful he must have felt, that not only did he feel so bad about himself that he wanted to die, but he felt like he'd failed because he didn't actually manage to do it. And then he got put on probation. So it was a pretty rubbish time in his life. And because, you know, I was very, very new to this career, I think it was actually the first pre-sentence report that I wrote. So I was really getting chucked in at the deep end, which was good. That's what I liked doing in my career. I'm the kind of person who, you know, if I'm not too sure about something, I'll go and speak to other people who are more experienced. And so I did that. And the first person that I spoke to was a very experienced probation officer, and she was really, really judgmental. I was actually very shocked by her reaction. And she just kind of went off on this train of, well, he was so selfish and he could have killed kids who were playing in the lounge room. And, you know, he should have thought about that. And, you know, he should be sent to prison. And I thought, wow, okay, well, I won't carry on my conversation with you because I don't agree. I know that's not the right train of thought. You know, what are you doing in this job? And I think that's the kind of the older, cynical probation officer who's been in the job for a bit too long and maybe burnt out.
Yeah.
I was really struck by her judgmentalness around the situation. I thought, well, that's not how I feel. I actually have a lot of compassion for this person. And I don't think that's the right approach to take. But I did find myself thinking, God, I'm really glad that she's not the one to be writing this report, because it would have ended up being a very different report, clouded by her judgment, clouded by her beliefs around what it is to be suicidal or do a suicidal act. She'd never met this person before and she was making all these judgments about him. And so, you know, if we find ourselves talking to someone who is suicidal, we know them, maybe we have no idea who they are, but we have to approach it with compassion. It doesn't matter how we feel about suicide, about suicidal thoughts, suicidal acts, whether we know much about mental illness or not. But we have to leave our own judgment out of it if we're going to truly help that person and make them feel like they're being heard. And you know, that can, if that's too hard to do, then it's best left with someone else dealing with that person, because, you can't come from a place that's full of judgment and full of limiting beliefs about what's right or wrong for that person.
Yeah, I would think that that would just feed in to the person's feeling of lack of, you know, of inadequacy or lack of worthiness, you know, all of the things that they're feeling, it would just probably just amplify that.
Absolutely. And they just think it, you may as well be saying to them, well, go on then, do it. Which actually, you know, some suicidal people are continuously told that, because there are lots of people who have multiple attempts. And then people will see that as just a cry for help. And yeah, on some level, it's definitely a cry for help. It's them crying out to the universe and to people that they know, I don't want to keep feeling this way and I don't know what to do about it. But it's not, you know, a lot of people take that cry for help as an attention-seeking act. And there's very few people who will do it as a way of seeking attention. In some ways, it is a way of seeking attention, that cry out for help, but people take that as the wrong message, you know, like they're just doing it just to cause some drama, and you know, it's never really about that. But if you have that judgment where this person, well, you know, well, you've tried 7 times already, go ahead, I don't believe that you're going to do it. One day they will actually do it, and then you're left knowing that that's the last thing you said to them.
Exactly.
And you have to live with that on your conscience. Yeah,
that's awful. Now, you know, if someone is intent on killing themselves, you know, really intent on it, you know, they will. I mean, you know, I mean, ultimately they'll be successful. So, you know, as a counselor, or even if a friend or family member, how do we keep from feeling that it was kind of like our responsibility to prevent that from happening?
It's such a tricky one. I've spent nearly 10 years kind of overcoming that journey myself, I suppose. It's probably a few years ago now that I really felt like I got over that feeling of feeling responsible, like it was all my responsibility to help and rescue that person. It's not. It's never our responsibility. It's a responsibility of ours to do the best that we can, you know, to help that person, to find the right support for them, or, you know, to have non-judgmental, very open, honest, loving, compassionate conversations with people, if we're able to put ourselves in that position. But it's not, their survival is not our responsibility. So I had a conversation with someone recently I'd shared a video on what do you do if you're depressed and suicidal. It was a Facebook Live that I did. And I talked about taking baby steps. And he saw that video. He's in South Africa. He saw that video and just reached out to me, and which was a brave thing to do on his part. He was very socially isolated. He felt like he had no one in his life that he could talk to. And he, you know, we got on Skype together, and he was talking about how he was sick of people telling him to just think positively. And I let him know at that point, I'm not that coach who will tell you to think positively when you're depressed and suicidal. I'm just not that person. It's not realistic, going back to the baby steps and the incremental upgrades that you can do on your emotions. You know, I'm not going to be unrealistic about it and say that you can go from feeling suicidal to thinking positively. It's just not the way it happens. And so we kept in touch. And then I think it was the next week or the week after, he, bearing in mind he's on South African time, he was kind of messaging me quite early in the morning. And he didn't, I offered a Skype call to him. He didn't want to get on Skype. He just wanted to keep it over Messenger. And he was basically saying, I've got a handful of pills here. And he tried several attempts before that. And I guess I've got to a stage where, because I've accepted that if someone really, really will kill themselves, they will do it regardless of what you say or do. And I also accept that that is personal choice. They are their own person. It's completely their choice whether they live or die, which is in some ways a bit of a harsh reality to accept, isn't it? But it is totally their choice. And so there's me in Australia, there's him in South Africa. I know there's nothing I can do for him really, except for just be there and be there on Messenger, which is, you know, you can't really get your points across as well over Messenger as over Skype.
Right.
But, you know, I said to him, okay, well, you've let me know already that you've attempted 7 times and it hasn't worked out for you. So what makes you think it will work out this time? And I'm not sure many people would kind of approach a conversation in that way. But I was kind of getting him to look at it from different angles. And he said, well, I've got triple the dose this time. I said, okay, so have you considered the possibility that if it doesn't work, if you take that amount of medication and it doesn't work out, that you could actually just end up as a vegetable with an alive brain and a dead body and not actually being able to attempt suicide again? I just was trying to, you know, pose right. a bit of a reality right. to him as well, you know.
Uh-huh.
And you know, he kind of didn't really go into that as much, but it definitely got him thinking. I didn't hear from him for the rest of the day, actually for a couple of days, and I was kind of left with that feeling of, I think he's actually done it. But I knew that because of the way that I'd approached that conversation, where I wasn't another person telling him, well, go on, do it then. I don't believe you're going to do it. And I also wasn't another person saying, well, just think positively, you'll snap out of it, you know,
right.
and desperately trying to get him not to do it. Because quite often people come from those two camps. Either they're almost egging the person on because they feel like they're going to call their bluff, or they're desperately trying to get them not to do it because they don't know how else to approach it. Whereas I come from a bit of a different perspective, where I let them know, okay, well, I know that if you're going to do it, you're going to do it. And I've got no say in that. I'm not going to try and talk you out of it or talk you into it, but I'm here for you if you want to talk. And just by, I always let them know that just by the pure fact that they are talking about it means that something is holding them back from going ahead with it.
Right.
So I was left with this feeling of, okay, well, he's not contacted me. I think he's done it. I don't know where he lives. I don't know anyone that he knows. You know, he's literally just a random person that had contacted me, and I didn't know how to go about finding out other than waiting for him to contact me again, which he did a couple of days later. And he said he'd broken up in a lot of pain, in a wet bed, you know, and was really in a lot of pain. And we kind of carried on talking for the next couple of weeks. So I knew that because I'd been the way that I'd been with him, it left the door open where if he, by some miracle, did break up, that I'd probably be the first person that he would speak to. So
yeah.
It's really about allowing that person to feel supported no matter what the decision is, no matter what your judgment is around it. It doesn't matter what your feeling is about suicide. Unless you've been there, you really can't make a judgment about it. You don't know. You don't know what they're going through. No one, even if you have been suicidal, you still don't know what that person is going through, and how isolated and awful they would feel. So it's not up to us whether they suicide or not. It's up to them. But if they don't, and if you're there, then they'll come to you. And you know, my brother for me is totally on that pedestal of knowing that your life can completely change. He never ever thought he'd have the life that he has now. I know that life can be different for people. It's just about finding something, some smidgen of hope and something that works to help push that person out of those emotions, because feelings are temporary and they can change. Sure, some feelings can last for years and it can really suck, but they still are temporary.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, it's great to have that living example in your brother to be able to draw from and to be encouraged by. Gosh, we're getting down toward the end of the show. We've only got like five more minutes, but there was one more area or question that I kind of wanted to address, and that is forgiveness. You know, what role does that play in forgiving oneself for someone who may have committed suicide around them, or forgiving that person for doing it?
Forgiveness is probably my number one go-to tool out of all the tools in my toolbox. If I could only ever do one for the rest of my life, that would be it. I also do energy work, so I teach Reiki and I do energy treatments. So I know the impact that resentment and holding on to ill feelings towards yourself or to other people has on your energy field. And I liken it to, I love the metaphor, it's like carrying around a sack of potatoes, and for each thing that you hold on to that you're not allowing yourself to let go of or forgive, you're chucking another potato in there. So eventually we get to a stage where we just feel so bogged down by life. We don't even really know sometimes what it's about. But if you can do forgiveness work, it's kind of the equivalent of dropping a potato out of the sack, and eventually you feel lighter and lighter and lighter. And actually, I just did, I was feeling pretty heavy leading up to World Suicide Prevention Day, and created quite a few videos that week, did a lot of sharing, and I felt quite emotional that morning, which surprised me actually, because I feel like I'm quite detached from it a lot of the time. And then I have this constant kind of forgiveness memories list that I do. I've actually on, if you go onto my website and search forgiveness in the top bar, there'll be a recent blog and video interview that I did on it, which explains the way that I do forgiveness, which is a really easy way of doing it. And I found my forgiveness list, and it was really interesting that the whole of the first page that I looked at of all these kind of memories I'd written down to forgive was all about my brother's last suicide attempt and my kind of operation cleanup from it. Wow. And the way that my family dealt with it. And when I sat down to do the forgiveness work on that, oh God, that was on Monday. And I'd had a period of feeling quite heavy for about 3 weeks leading up to that. And I just forgave 5 memories, and I've literally felt incredible for the rest of the week. Releasing that energy from your energy field, you seriously feel so much lighter, and it's such a simple tool to do. You know, when you talk about forgiveness in a vague sense, you think, well, how do I do that? Or why should I forgive that? People like holding on to stuff, I think. But it literally is like drinking poison and expecting the other person to die. So if you find yourself unwilling to forgive, then that will eventually create physical and mental ill health for you, which is really, it's just all that toxic energy that you're holding on to will come out in some way. So by forgiving it and by releasing the past, it's not like it's necessarily changing the past, but it's changing your perception and your feelings around it. So you can really move on from it. It's really, really powerful work.
Well, that's great. Well, that's a wonderful tool, and definitely, you know, encourage people to go ahead and go to your website and check that out. And it seems like you have some really wonderful tools to assist people, Carly. And so that's great. And I encourage everyone to give you a call. Now that, I mean, we're such a global community that you can contact you through Messenger or through Skype. Mm. So, I mean, it's, you know, or through your website. So any final words you may want to share with listeners, maybe anything about what you offer, you know, as far as services that maybe we didn't get into that you'd like to let people know about?
Yeah, so I've been coaching for 8 years now, but I've really only recently, you know, people talk about how you should niche yourself as a coach, and I never felt like I wanted to do that. I kind of been on the bandwagon of wanting to help everybody, but I realized that my niche had kind of found me, and that, you know, I'd spent so long working in mental health, and you know, as I've explained, a lot of suicidal people in my life, which, you know, wasn't a call out for that, but
choice,
it just kind of happened. And I've just found myself naturally being able to deal with it in a positive way. So I've kind of in the last few months really been focusing on these are the people that I really want to help. So whether you're feeling suicidal, whether you know someone who's feeling suicidal, or whether you're just going through some kind of change in your life, so that could be moving country, it could be financial issues, it could be a relationship breakdown, some kind of trauma or change or crisis in your life, where you're just really feeling stuck and feeling like you just need a bit of a nudge forward with it. This is now the kind of coaching I'm doing. I'm just really helping people to get unstuck, I suppose. And you know, that feeling when you're just really stuck in the mud, I'm finding a lot of the clients that I deal with are really feeling that way, where they're just stuck in the mud and they're really struggling to get out. So the tools that I teach are really, they're really simple, they're really effective. I'm a big fan of the keep it simple, stupid kind of tools. There's nothing really complex there. You know, I really want to pass on everything I know about how to move forward, having been there myself. I know it can be really easy, but also I know that you really need the support at that time.
Yeah, that's great. And that is, you know, you obviously have a knack for that. So that's, you know, it's a wonderful area of specialty. And it's just one that is really so important. So I want to really thank you for your time today, Carly. I really enjoyed
our
conversation. I know this will be helpful.
Thank you. It's been amazing to speak to you.
Thank you very much. Again, everyone, today my very special guest joining us from Australia has been Carly Evans, and we've been talking about her global mission and passion of suicide reduction and prevention. And again, you can find out more about Carly by visiting her website, which is www.carly.com. And again, there is a direct link to her website in the show page description. And definitely go to her website and get some of those tools for yourself. I'm sure you will be very happy that you did. So everyone, thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. And until we meet again, thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Be sure to visit our website at www.biteradio.me. That's biteradio.me. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Bite Radio Me. And our shows are also available as a free podcast from iTunes. And until we meet again, remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.